final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive. And a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the Western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
in a butt and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Shazoo's Mad Science. Hope you're all doing well out there. Been joined by a couple of good friends of mine, Muddy Mudman and my friend Steve. And so, with that said, how you guys doing today?
Good morning.
Good morning. We lost Steve there, or what? He went to sleep.
Hello.
There he is. Bonjour. Anyway, I spent the last week, guys, before I get into that, I put a video in there, a link to one of Ryan's videos. It's got a nifty little diode there you might want to check out there, because There's some really good rare minerals and materials, exotic materials as I like to call them, out there that are pretty much good for picking up energy. And I won't go into too much of that detail right out of the gate, but we all know about germanium. And through my research, I found that stainless steel, cheapo stainless steel, and aluminum are really good for picking up radiant energy. And all the pieces of the puzzle will fall into place when it's all said and done. But go check out Tesla's wireless energy patent, and you'll start getting an idea on what he was talking about. Plus, check out the static motors, which I'm going to talk about here pretty quick, and see how they actually function. And if you can Google up the atmospheric group and find the work that they've been doing, you can see that they're pulling static energy out of the air, because from the ground to the atmosphere up there, you'll build up a static charge the higher you go. There's actually an equation out there that will tell you how many volts you can get per how many ever feet you're going up in the air. And you can actually get out there on YouTube and see people using little quadcopters to fly a thin wire up in the air and bring down a static charge to actually run some of these static motors. Cultus tried to do it with some helium balloons. It didn't go over so well for him because the wind didn't want to cooperate, so his balloons were flying, you know, across the way or whatever. But
yeah, there was a guy on YouTube took a helium balloon and a weather balloon, and he sent it up with a piece of foil at the top. And basically, about 300 foot of pretty light gauge wire, not enough, and there wasn't much wind. But he was bringing it down to a crystal set to see what he could pick up. And he basically, from 10 feet away, without a battery, he could you could hear it on his you could hear the radio on his camera. And he put it over to an LED. It blew that sucker almost instantly, instead of using the crystal diode. And when he touched the wire, he got a nasty burn.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. You know, we talk about free energy and alternative energy, green energy, whatever, you know, and there's people out there looking for zero point, no reunity, which, you know, I always talk to everybody about free energy. Energy is free. We're floating in a sea of it. I mean, you go to pay your light bill, it's not necessarily free. You go to buy materials to do build generators, it's not free. But once you've got your self-contained generator, then, and that's working in harmony with nature, then it is literally free. You know, you buy your solar panel, you're not paying for that electricity. The sun's never sent you a bill. At least it has never sent me a bill. I've been using solar panels for quite some time. But either way, free energy is what nature has provided. You know, if you don't believe in free energy, ask a few of those people out there who's had their houses blown over by 200 or 300 mile an hour winds and such from tornadoes. Or, you know, out to sea, South China Sea is a good prime example. There's like 16-foot waves all year round out there. It's not a very pleasant place to go on a joyride out there in the South China Sea. I got a few seasickness episodes out of that deal. But it's a definite ride. But either way, that's a lot of power. That is a lot of potential energy. There was a guy that put a video out some time back where he made a little generator that, as the waves were coming in, it was moving a paddle back and forth that was literally turning a turbine or turning a generator head inside there, and he was getting electricity just out of the ocean waves alone. So
yeah, another one where they throw the anchor down there, and they got a basic inner tube, and as the waves bring it up and down, it's got some horsepower. It generates power as well on that.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about saltwater batteries, how much better could you get than seawater? You know, there's a lot of salt in sea.
Yeah, just dump you a copper plate and a lead plate, and good to go.
And we all know that a lot of people know that ships out there, they put a sacrificial metal on the side of the boat to keep the boats from corroding, because it does like electrolysis process on the deal, keeps it from rotting away real fast because of that salt in the ocean. So it's better that it goes to that sacrificial piece of metal on the ship than, you know, through the hole, obviously. You want to pump water out, then that's your game, if you can swim well.
And you got to use rivets of the same metal.
Yeah.
Or just, it'll rot holes.
But,
just a slight variation on what you were saying earlier about the inner tube. There was clever fellas up in the Scandinavian region built an underwater kite.
That's pretty cool.
Basically, what you've got is a kite underwater with the wave motions. We'll lift it up and down, and it's hooked up to a piezoelectric crystal setup at the bottom. And every time it goes up, it pulls a pulley. Every time it goes down, it returns it, and you get energy both ways.
You see, and that's the kind of ideas that I like, you know, out of the box kind of thinking. You know, there's a lot of pressure underneath the ocean, and that pressure can change with the waves, you know, underwater waves. So, you know, that, the kite, the piezoelectric effect and such like that, there's so many different ways that you could actually draw energy without even harming nature, you know, through just the ocean alone. And, you know, you got the wind, you got the sun, and Ryan also did a video, which I should have jumped over on his channel and got that link. He's got a water wheel in a local stream that by his property there, and he's generating electricity. I think he said something that he's getting 6 volts out of this thing, you know. There's probably better, you know, ways to get more voltage out of it, and... you know, but either way, it's really nice. He built this thing out of wood. It's in the stream. It's not harming the environment. It's generating constant power. So it's impressive. So there is many different methods by which you can get free energy. And that's what we talk about on here all the time.
Sure is.
Yeah.
I lived in Holland for 6 years. Holland is kind of flat, and it's very, very much below sea level. And they're quite famous for their electrical storms. Now, if anybody said that to me that energy was, or electricity was really, really difficult to collect, I'd have to say, well, if that's the case, why do they have dirty great big lumps of metal, i.e. lightning rods, on most of the houses in Holland? They're all built roughly the same height. It's not difficult to collect, it's just a bit more complicated to collect it safely.
Yeah, well, there's methods by which you can do that, and you can actually store that energy. That's the key right there. You know, I've been messing around for the last week here, and I've been working on the static motor. And by all standards, this static motor should not run at all, period. Number one, it's the rotor is entirely too heavy. It's not balanced out. It's pretty much not measured very much. It's kind of eyeballed it in to try to get it straight and such. And it should not work, because the average static motor out there, the atmosphere motors out there, are really lightweight rotors. And if they ain't perfectly balanced on the deal, you won't get them to run. I fought and fought trying to build a pill bottle static motor like Lid Motor did, and that guy must have patience of steel, because he gets his stuff to work. He's not only made a motor, but he's also made a generator out of little pill bottles. And I tried, couldn't get that going.
Now, just a point of clarity, if people think a static motor is a police car outside a donut shop, they've tuned into the wrong show.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a lot of energy in that donut, obviously.
Well, sugar makes the world go round, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so, anyway, I tried unsuccessfully for gosh knows how long in order to get a doggone static motor to work. And I could get it to almost get ready to go, but then it wouldn't go because it was either off balance, or one side was heavier than the other, or whatever. If you ain't got the, so much as the aluminum tape on there, you know, the same size, it'll be off balance. And these things are not, they don't produce enough torque to do anything. You know, and the ones that I have seen out there, Brimstar.org, he does one. He's out there on YouTube. He's got a really good one, static motor. Lid Motor's done a few good ones, and there are a few other ones out there. Jeremy Gewilt, he's out there. He's got a really nice one. It's pretty powerful. But some of the ones, the energy input on the startup side is, you know, pretty substantial compared to what I'm talking about. And so with that said, you really can't get a lot of work done with a static motor as they stand. And so the one that I've been working on, I hope to get a video up here pretty soon, but I gotta do a few things on it in order to get the doggone thing to function on demand as opposed to when it feels like it. Once I get that everything fixed up, I'm going to put a video out there. But even after that point, by all standards, this thing should not work. I mean, the current laws of physics. It's too heavy. It's totally off balance. I mean, you can see that whenever you're watching a rotor spin. It's a wobbling to and fro, you know. And it's not precision at all. However, I watched this thing run. My friend watched it run. We watched it run for over 5 minutes on its own deal there. And I was pretty impressed. I asked him, because I didn't believe it myself. I said, is it my imagination or is that doggone thing running? And he said, it's running.
How many RPMs were you looking at?
I don't know. I didn't have no way to actually meter it, but it was doing pretty good. It was picking up speed on it. And if, like I said, if I could have got past the flaws in the actual building of the doggone thing, it'd be working right now. But
was it turning like a 30? The speed of a 33 album, a 45 record, 78, or
I would probably say probably faster, a little bit faster.
Oh yeah, that sounds great.
And
I was thinking, man, I emptied out. You know them round Morton salt deals that you fill up your salt shakers with?
Yeah.
Man, that has got one thick cardboard tube on the outside. That thing is stout. And nice cardboard on the side. I was looking at that, and I was thinking of building me an Atmo motor with it. Like Boomer says, you know, why did he build that doggone 10 or 12 foot pendulum that weighs 650 pounds? Because he doesn't like working with small things. He can build bigger things easier.
Yeah, and there's a lot of easier ways that you can troubleshoot it whenever it's that size as well.
Right.
You can physically see what's going on. But
his gears were off a bike, you know, the big sprocket off of bicycles and stuff, man.
Here's the dilemma that I was having with mine, because I tried probably 100 different wiring configurations on this deal to try to get it just so. And it at one point, when I got the doggone thing running, there could have been static energy coming from... let me start off with this. I started running this thing with a Van de Graaff generator, all right? And a Van de Graaff generator build up one heck of a static charge. However, it's not necessarily enough to do what it is that I'm talking about doing. And
it's
so, hold on a second. That one wire actually will put energy out of the wire itself. You can actually watch it arc across. And at one point, I had a wire that was actually laying across that wire. And so I had to figure out whether or not it was because that wire was touching that other wire, why it worked, or what. So it's a matter of accidentally figuring out how the doggone thing was functioning. What was you about to say, Steve?
You do realize that a Van de Graaff generator is not a hairdryer.
No, but it's a good for mad science. I mean, you'd stick your hair up there like
I used to. I'm just looking at your picture there, and I wondered if you confused the two. I didn't want to disrupt your train of thought, but what I would say, okay, what is probably the most aggressive energetic level of static electricity that people can see with their own eyes.
Lightning.
I was going to say that, but I didn't want to make a fool of myself.
Oh, no. No.
Fire's pretty good, too.
Lightning.
So, lightning is the definition of static electricity, because you've got a positive and negative charge, and you've got electrons basically breaching the gap.
Yeah, and not only that, you can see four separate powers that that lightning, one lightning bolt has. It not only it produces heat, produces high voltage, it produces visible light, and it literally produces an acoustic wave from the pressure of this discharge that, you know, you can audibly hear for miles away. You can see the light from miles away. You know,
it has a definite resonant frequency.
Generally, yeah. Whenever you see a lightning bolt, unless you're extremely unlucky, it's miles away from you, you know. If you're unfortunate enough to be standing in the general vicinity, you'll feel the true power. I mean, there's been people had holes burnt through their shoe, you know, and top of their hat such.
One point to make is there is that a much explosive charge in one single lightning bolt. When they took basically combat planes up to the upper level of the Earth atmosphere and turned on their infrared cameras, they found that there was discharges of gases leaving the Earth's atmosphere by at least 15 kilometers. That's nearly 9 miles above the Earth's atmosphere. When a lightning bolt hits the ground, it also discharges gas out of the Earth's atmosphere. You can see it on YouTube. Go and look it up. They've actually got military planes with cameras that can see the jet of gas going up.
Well, that's a lot of power, man. That is a lot of power. And static electricity is probably the most prevalent energy out there available, outside of sunlight and wind and that kind of stuff there. But it's the easiest to produce. I mean, anybody rubbing their tennis shoes across the carpet can run over and zap their brother on the ear. You're building up electrons on there, and if you're charged higher than your brother, then your brother is unfortunately going to get zapped. A few times when I tried to give my wife a kiss, a lightning bolt would jump across my lip to hers, and she'd like me, what are you doing? I said, that's my electric personality, baby. You know, she like
keeps
the
mad science mojo.
Yeah. So, anyway, on back to the static motor. I'm for my rotor. I'm using literally cheapo stainless steel to be my rotor, and so I did this intentionally because I wanted to see the difference between, you know, the aluminum and the different types of metals of how they could pick up the static energy. And for what I've figured out, you could probably use any metal and it would still work. Whether some work better or hold a better charge than the others, most of these folks that are building static motors are using you know, like razor blades and stuff like that. So there's yet even a different metal in there. But this thing, like I said, it's too heavy to work, and it's lopsided. Definitely not precision. And truthfully, whenever I started building it, I didn't think I was going to have much success in ever seeing a doggone thing work. However, I had a whole lot of success in shocking the crud out of myself repeatedly for the last week, because I was taking the static energy and I built some customized capacitors that I actually got to redesign, because there's probably about less than an eighth of an inch between plates down there, and after it gets up to a certain charge, it will actually discharge across itself if you don't have a smaller gap on the other side.
You can't put an insulator between them.
Yeah, well, that's what they do got some insulation between there, but the plates themselves actually needed to be farther apart, and so, you know, I'm going to have to redo those, but that's not that big deal.
Faster work much better when the plates are closer. if you can extend your insulating material out.
No, I understand what you're saying, but not when I talk about the plates being close, they're fine. They're fine as far as the layers go. What I'm saying is that the way that the prongs that you actually have there to touch across for the power, one of the plates is too close to the opposite prong. There's not enough distance between the two, and so whenever it builds up a charge high enough inside there, it will discharge across itself. So that's the problem. But you're right, that's how a capacitor is built, that you want the two plates to be close together with an insulator between them. But
what I was trying to get at is if you extend your insulator out past the metal surface, you can it takes more of a distance to arc across, and you could also run that between your terminals as well.
Yeah. But either way, what I did was had the static generator, the Van de Graaff generator, shooting a charge across the spark gap into the capacitors and charging up the capacitors. And that way, whenever the probes on both sides of the rotor, the positive and negative, when it build up a charge, it would literally jump across there, and you could see the visible difference between just the Van de Graaff arc and the capacitive discharge at the same time. You could see a definite difference in the strength of that power. And the stronger I got that pulse, you could literally watch this rotor as it would jump every time that static discharge was going across there, just like I said. And so, I'm getting the punch of a lightning bolt, across to that rotor. And there was a couple incidents while trying to configure my wiring on this different deal. I touched the wrong things at the wrong time, and I got lit up by those homemade capacitors. And to make things even better, I went and put a larger capacitor on there and had that punching it even harder, and got hit a few times with that. So if you were a fly on the wall at old Shaziz's house, then you would have heard some bleeping going on there, and I'd be like, "Oh man, it was rough." But I was really pleased when I saw this thing work, because, like I said, by normal standards, it should not have worked at all, and it did. I took and used a little bit of information that I got from whenever they built them levitation lifters. I don't know what they call them. They take basically aluminum foil and make either a ring or a kite looking deal. And when they hit it with a static charge, they'll get these things to literally float. Using that knowledge and the way that the atmospheric motor works, I was able to get this thing to turn. And if everything gets balanced out the way it should be and I get the video done, it'll be a self-starter. You won't have to reach down there and try to get it to spin, which with some of these little static motors, they've already accomplished on a smaller scale. But to turn this rotor, I think that would be a really good accomplishment.
I hear you.
And like I said, it's off balance. It's not precision in the slightest, and it should not work because it's too heavy. There's not enough torque according to the way these static motors work to make a difference. But it's really interesting to watch as this charge is getting ready to happen. You can literally see it's kind of hard to explain. Have you ever seen heat rising on the street?
Right.
Yeah, those waves of kind of distortion there from the heat rising? Right,
yeah.
Before this static discharge, and you're watching in between the rotor, you can literally see that same exact effect as it's building up right there. And then as soon as that static discharge jumps across there, you can watch the rotor, not just the rotor alone jump, but you can watch all the connecting wires to the entire system jump as well. So there's a lot of potential energy force going on there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And if you ever go out and watch guys like Russ doing like he did a railgun video, you can watch him. And there's a photo induction guy out there. I like him. He cracks me up. I worry about him sometimes though, because he's messing around with some ludicrously insane power and blowing stuff up. You know.
If he doesn't get the result he wants, he goes, "That's not good enough."
Yeah.
He's got some equipment.
He had a really high-powered laser one time. He's running around burning holes in the furniture with it, and he says that's probably not going to make his wife too happy. The guy cracks me up. Anyway, there's a lot of really good researchers out there. But if you watch these videos while they're firing their rail guns or whatever, don't pay no attention to the rail gun. Pay attention to the wiring that's connected to everything. When that static charge builds up and it's getting ready to discharge, you can literally watch the wire begin to coil and recoil and literally jump. And so, once again, that's proof of what I'm saying. There is a massive amount of pressure building up right before that static discharge. And if you can take and harness that static discharge in what I'm saying, you could literally build an electric motor, a static motor that would rival any electric motor out there in standard sense, and absolutely no copper wire necessary to do it. And all the materials that you need to build it are pretty much things that people throw away on a daily basis. Tons of plastic floating in the water out in the ocean, you know, trash everywhere, plastic everywhere. There's tons of it. There's aluminum out there. There's cheap stainless steel from China, you know. it's mind-boggling. And aluminum, in my mind, and cheap stainless steel are some of the exotic materials out there that are basically the equivalents of what that video that I posted over there at ShazizRadio.com in the Super Chat room there, and over there at the Awake Radio that Ryan is doing with that dial that he's showing that John Hutchinson was messing around with.
Yeah,
there's a lot of exotic materials out there that have the capabilities of picking up light, energy of all sorts. You know, we all know about the germanium dial because of the crystal radio. People use germanium to basically pick up a signal. And so that's another one of the materials out there.
I got a question.
Yeah.
Slightly complicated. Might be just simple as well. When you make the core of your Atmo motor, you've got a cylinder that's insulative, and then it's got metal on it. Is that one continuous sheet that makes a connection all the way around, or is that several different sheets that are insulated from each other?
Well, I've seen it done in all different fashions. I've seen a solid a solid rotor where it was just one continuous sheet all the way around. I've also seen little split sections like you'd see on a regular rotor, and
like you see on the Windsor scale.
Yeah, and I've also seen the ones where there were like two half sheets on there, and all of them seem to work. And basically, all you're doing is you're putting a whole lot of electrons on the one, and then that charge wants to go around and catch over to the negative side. You know, opposites attract. And so when that happens and it goes across and discharges on the other side, there's where you get your motion. The one that I'm doing is, if you can picture two flat stainless steel rings inside of each other, offset, you know, halfway from each other, that's it's all one connection, except for the gaps that are in between there. And like I said, by all standards, it should not have worked, but it did. And I watched this thing run for a good 5 minutes before I had decided to mess with the wiring, and then I had a problem. But I'll get it. All I got to do is get my wiring configuration down and get everything on the positive and negative poles over there adjusted right. And there's another thing, too, is that you got to get those things adjusted to where they're not slamming into the rotor, but they're not connecting with the rotor as well. And they need to be balanced out. You know, however wide the gap is on one side, it needs to be on the other side, which with mine, it is not. And that's one of the reasons why I said by all standards, it should not have functioned. But it did. It built up enough charge on there to move that heavy old out-of-balance rotor and get it to spinning. So, somebody talk, because I need a breath.
Well, I've basically cleared up. Did you experience any torque in that motor? Did it have any sizable torque where you could grab the shaft and slow it down, or did that kind of just stop it if you did that?
Well, no, I didn't. Basically, you don't want to touch the doggone rotor when it's going, because it has a charge on it, and it will light you up. But just the fact that it turned shows me that it has torque. And if you could sit there and watch it before it actually got to turning, you could sit there and watch as it jumps. And so the weight of this rotor, I'm going to have to actually take the rotor off and put it on a scale and measure it. But the weight of this rotor is way above what it should be in order to be able to be a regular static motor. And I did that intentionally and basically didn't make it as precision as it should be, in order to, if I could get this piece of junk to turn at the weight that it is, then I knew what I was talking about was right. Because if it has enough power to push that doggone thing, then you know it's got torque. Yeah, quiet air, dead air.
I hear you. Sorry, I was a little distracted trying to do something while I was listening as well.
Well,
I figure with a bigger diameter, like that salt refill container, it has more leverage, just like, inch pounds and foot pounds. You know, you put the same pounds a couple inches, you don't have much torque. You put the same amount of pressure out there at a foot, it's got a lot more torque.
Yeah, and this one that I got is about the equivalent to the size of a standard softball. You know how big a softball is, right?
Right.
And it's about that big, but it's made out of cheap stainless steel. And so it's a lot heavier than it should be. But it works.
Well, so yours is a continuous connection all the way around.
Well, in some sense, yeah, but if you can picture two loops. You've got one solid, probably about an inch wide loop that goes all completely in a circle, and then you got another identical one that is offset halfway and inside there. So it almost looks like an egg beater.
Shaziz, not to be rude and interrupt, but I don't live in the center of the universe, and I've never seen a softball.
Oh. Well, croquet ball?
Well, about the size of a grapefruit.
Yeah, there you go, grapefruit. Yeah, I'll put a video out of it. But, you know, like I said, static energy is really easy to tap into. I mean, everybody's experienced it at some point in their life, static energy. And that energy can be stored in a capacitor. The key in this whole deal is not a direct contact. You're letting like little mini lightning bolts jump from place to place. And when that happens, however you want to explain it in the laws of physics, if you allow this doggone thing to put like a capacitor to bring itself up to its ultimate charge, It's full potential. It's going to discharge one of two ways. You're either going to blow that capacitor up, or it's going to discharge across terminals or jump to the nearest, the shortest point that it can find. That energy is going to release somehow, some way. But if you allow it to come up to its full potential, you'll get the full charge out of this thing, and the same thing is happening with the spark gap, you know. In Tesla coils, you'll always see how they got to get the spark cap tuned just right in order, when it's jumping across that spark gap, they get the full potential of that energy coming out. Same thing with the static energy, but as you're jumping across that gap, you don't have to worry about rectifying any electricity, because it's already rectified. I mean, it's a one-way trip for that energy. So you got DC current going on, and it charges up that doggone capacitor pretty doggone fast. And if you touch that capacitor, you're going to understand what I'm saying. Now you're playing with power. But the force, the pressure buildup of that lightning, that little micro bolt of lightning, is what I'm using to turn the rotor. It's not as simple as what we were talking about, to how the static motor functions, as far as you're building up a negative charge on there. That negative wants to go around to the opposite charge and discharge and getting turned that way. This is actually pressure that is hitting the surface of the rotor and causing it to go. You see what I'm saying? Once that pressure comes out and then it's negatively charged, it goes around and all obviously wants to discharge on the opposite side. Well, there's the secondary force going on in there. So you're getting pressure from the get-go and a negative discharge on the opposite side, and that gives this thing more power than the average static motor. I've actually seen rimstar.org did a really good one. It has a lot of torque, and I'm pretty much believing that his is doing exactly what I'm talking about. I don't know whether he's realized this or not, but part of the power, the reason why that thing has as much torque, is because of the way that that static charge is making it across the other side. It starts to push on one side, and it also pulls on the opposite side right out of the gate. And then when that thing gets around there, then it discharges on the opposite side, which now you got another force going on. You understand what I'm saying?
Right. Unlike charges attract, so what's in the middle is in between the two, and they're both attracting.
Yeah. And I can't wait to get this doggone thing up and running. I can't wait for people to see this work, because it should not work. And as a secondary to this deal, I've got a couple neon bulbs. One at the bottom and one built into the top of the ring that I got going on. And so when this thing pulses, you can determine by just the brightness of that neon bulb how powerful that doggone discharge is getting ready to be. I mean, that you can watch that bulb go from dim to really bright right before that discharge. And so it's pretty cool. I can't wait for everybody to be able to see that. But either way, you get this thing and you're going, and you can build literally a static motor that, in my belief, will rival any electric motor out there on the market. And there's absolutely no copper wire involved in the entire deal. Matter of fact, when I use my connection wires, I use some steel wire instead of copper, just to get away from the copper. The only copper in the whole deal is the copper tubing that's going around, that's actually the structure that holds it up. But inside of it is a really tightly wound coil that is picking up static energy, which is what's actually lighting up those neon bulbs. Pretty cool stuff, man.
Sounds like fun.
So you guys got any thoughts on static energy?
I'm seriously trying to find a way to get fluorescent tubes to ignite with static electricity.
Well, there's another thing too. Quite some time back, we talked about some different types of lights that you had. If you can get me some information on those lights, maybe I can buy them over here cheaper. And I'm 100% positive I can light them things up with way less energy than they actually require. Are the bulbs that you're talking about, are they like fluorescent bulbs, or are they?
They're phosphorant tubes. Usually they run on about 13 watts. Between 13 to about 52, depending on the length. But the issue here is the amount of energy that you put into it when it excites the gas inside it. The energy potential dictates the amount of lumens that come out of it.
Yeah, I understand that. That's I still believe that you can do it with a static charge, you know, because there is a lot of power in that. A lot of power. Now, you don't believe me, man. You just stick your tongue on that one, boy. I tell you what.
No, thank you.
You know,
I did the Franklin Bell with one of those tennis rackets and electric tennis bug rackets. I did a Franklin Bell with that. It worked pretty good. I need to get the big one. I got the cheap one that I got at Walmart for like $5. Didn't really put out as much, but I got one that came from Northern, and that uses two D-cell batteries. That thing would be awesome. Also, in order to get better reception and stuff with the radio, I took a whole spool of wire. I threw that sucker over a tree, and then when it got to the other side of that one, I threw it over another tree. And I haven't really touched my tongue to it to find out what's there as far as electricity. I bet I can get something out of that.
Well, I'm sure you can. I put four extra 500-volt capacitors on my bug zapper fly swatter, and it turns bugs to dust. I mean, it's like literally disintegrates them.
Well, Muggy, Shaziz, do you remember last week we were seeing the guy with his OV-Unity device?
Are you talking about the one where he's running the generator into the huge transformers?
Yeah, about the power being radiant.
Yeah.
I've still got a book open to see how far you'll fly before you hit the floor.
Well, if scale models anything, how I come across the, whether you want to call it discovery or rediscovery, whenever I literally hit that, I had a aluminum disc and using it for a stand, and I had a metal rod sticking in that, and then at the top of it had a 3/4-inch neodymium magnet stuck to it. And when I hit that with a high static charge, it literally leaped off the floor. And I knew right then and there that this thing would work. So, with that said, you know, if you got hit by a lightning bolt, I could see you being launched clear across the field.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys. I went up an escalator in a shopping center about 2 weeks ago. And I got a hit off the actual railing itself. Do you ever jump onto an escalator and you get a static charge off it?
Only once.
I get it all the time.
Well, one of the things for sure, though, is they always ground everything. You know? Everything's grounded. The power poles outside are grounded. They ground the telephone poles and the light poles, everything. Radio towers, they're all grounded. And they must do that for a reason, you know?
Well, in fairness, Aziz, I nearly ground some poor little Asian girl because when it blew me hand off of the railing, it flicked up and then knocked her in the teeth, the poor woman.
Man,
it was like I had a case of full body Tourette's.
Yeah, you get an involuntary response.
Well, if you think about it, your nervous system is a chemical electrical system. If you put an electrical charge through frog's legs, which they did in the 17th century, you can make a move.
Yep, man, we're talking dead frogs too.
Yeah, well, I wasn't dead.
Yeah, well, she's lucky she didn't get laid out.
There are certain people in this world that cannot have electrical appliances in their house because they're so subject to static electricity, they'll touch a washing machine and they'll literally blow all the fuses in it. It'll actually burn out all the resistors, capacitors in the circuit board in the machine.
Well, and every time they're in any kind of industry to where they're making microchips and stuff like that, they always got like a little a leash thing on the wrist so that it's grounded off static discharge, don't destroy stuff. So we know for a fact that static energy has enough power to tear things up. I mean, look at a lightning bolt, for Pete's sake, man. You know, you can literally heat the sand to the extreme where you create glass. They call it a Folgerite. If you find lightning glass, save it, because that stuff is valuable. But it's probably all over the freaking planet, man. And all day long, every day, there is continuous lightning going on somewhere on this planet. There is so much energy out there that could be tapped into that is just crazy. But why don't we use it, man? That's the question. Why ain't we tapping into it? We know we can pull thousands of volts out of the air. I mean, according to the story of Benjamin Franklin tying the key to the kite and discovering electricity. I'm sure he wasn't the first one to discover electricity, but he probably the first one to discover if you get high up there in the air with a metal object that it'll bring down a static charge. I mean, they used to do it with rockets, little model rockets. Put a really fine wire taped to the side of a model rocket and shoot it up in the air, and the other end grounded to the dirt, and they would literally bring down man-made lightning. You know, I say man-made because they basically just triggered it, but that shortened the gap. The atmosphere in between the Earth and the ground, you know, the atmosphere positively charged, the Earth negatively charged, and it takes a lot of buildup at the top before you can ionize that air in between there and create a gap between there. And there's where my plasma technology comes in. You know, could you imagine the plasma ball that you could create if you could harness that much power?
I'd like to get a wire and go up there about 300 foot. That'd be awesome.
Well, do it like the old CBers did, man. Get you a big old pipe and then strap it to another pipe and then just keep pushing them up in the air.
Well, yeah.
Put you some guide wires on there to stabilize it.
Muddy, why not get onto a 299 foot tall building?
There ain't none built here out in the country.
You got grain towers, haven't you?
Yeah, but they're quite far away.
Well, yeah. You don't exactly live next door to them, I know, but you climb up a grain tower with a whole bunch of copper wire, and you stick a little rocket on the end of it and launch it from the top.
Yeah, there you go.
Stick it in a bucket of sand and see what happens.
I am going, I've got plenty of wire that basically, you know, that thin bell wire that they use to rig up the button for your garage door opener?
Yeah.
Real, you know, it's not a really heavy gauge, but it's got a good insulation on it. Basically, that insulation can come on. So I'm planning on playing with a weather balloon on one of them days where I'm looking at like 3 miles per hour, you know, and put a good, healthy helium inside the weather balloon, get that thing up there so it's got a lot of tug, and I'm pretty sure the wire will hold it.
There was a guy that was running around putting lightning bolts out on the beach in the sand, lightning rods out on the beach in the sand. I actually seen it in a movie as well. But he was putting his lightning rods down in the sand so that he could track lightning to it so that he could get lightning glass.
Well, you know why she did.
Because he made a lot of money with it.
Yes, yeah. Scientists were paying a lot of money to study this particular type of glass.
Well, that's why I was getting ready to say, Muddy, what he ought to do is get him a 50-gallon plastic drum and put a lightning rod in there and use his balloon or his rocket, whichever, to you know, use that as the ground rod and shoot that up in the air and get you some lightning glass in a barrel. It'd probably
now,
blow that barrel apart.
Now, I think what we should do is get one of those Roman ballistas you know, the counterweight swing arms that they used to chuck rocks at fortresses with.
Yeah.
And tie a bit of copper wire to Shaziz's ankles. Give him a trash helmet, and we'll all sort of stand back and hit the hammer so we release the mechanism and just see what happens.
Now, that would be a good viral video. Oh, yeah. Anyway, you know, static energy.
I can see us making videos, making a trebuchet.
Yeah.
Once you charge them capacitor banks up, man, you got a lot of potential energy. And that static buildup, like I said, you can see the reaction before it ever even discharges. Those wires begin to move. And if you look really closely in between the negative plates in the rotor, or the positive plates in the rotor for that matter, you can literally watch a distortion, just like it looks like whenever you're standing on a hot pavement and during the summertime, you can see the waves up there in the air, the distortion's going on. And when that thing jumps across there, there's a lot of pressure involved going on. And so if I can get this one to function exactly the way I say it, then there is no doubt in my mind that you could build a static motor that would rival any electric motor on the market today. And the faster these things get going, you throw in a generator on top of that, like a Wimshurst style generator that doesn't rely on that doesn't have the resistance that your normal generator head would have. The faster you get this thing going, the more energy that it's going to create, tap into, you know?
Right. It's also got its momentum.
Yeah.
So you're storing energy in that.
So you could literally, actually, to...
I don't know why Justin's being so quiet. He's talking about throwing uranium up there to help your wire collect.
Well, I also looked into that as well, you know, as far as a little piece of americium that I pulled out of a smoke detector to see about picking up that energy. But there's a lot of nuclear waste all over this planet, man. You could tap into that energy, and you could use that to run your generators without ever having to fire that doggone... normal power plant, nuclear power plant ever back up, you wouldn't have to worry about it. You know, just you'd have power forever and a day. That's as simple as that. When radioactive material decays, it releases energy. That energy, if you got a receiver on the opposite side, you can pick it up and you can store it.
Right. So all this talk about all this radiation spreading all over the doggone place, it's just going to make the Tesla device work that much better.
Yeah.
Well, she says, you know, I've moved into a new apartment.
Yeah, you said you did.
Well, one of the terms and conditions of the lease was to have no radioactive materials at all whatsoever.
But they got smoke detectors in there, don't they? That cesium source, oh my goodness.
I asked them to remove the microwave.
Yeah, and also the smoke detector, the carbon monoxide detector, and
oh yeah.
No TV if it's a tube type.
Oh yeah, a cathode ray tube. Yeah.
Well, everything is radiated, man. You know, it's just where the problem comes is when they refine radioactive material from its natural radiation. All right.
That means you can't have a cell phone, you can't have Wi-Fi, and you darn sure can't have them stupid smart meters, them dumb meters they got out there. That thing's put out over ten times what they call negligible.
When you take and you refine uranium and do it to this extent to where you now created some really super hot rods that are really super high radiation, there's where the danger lies, you know. But after these things depleted down and they ain't even got enough energy potential to boil water, they're not now not radioactive. They are continuously radioactive. They'll be radioactive until they completely depleted. And in nature, you'll find uranium everywhere. You know, there's radioactive stuff everywhere. And that's why when I saw that video that somebody posted in the chat room the other day, the one about that you was talking about, Steve, what was the name of that doggone video? Marcus Reed Crystal? No, that ain't it. Do you?
it was the Over Unity experiment. Yeah.
And he's talking about in there how energy, it's radiation that we're using, not the current form, the standard that the school teaches you about electricity. And I tend to believe him because of the way that it works. I mean, and we're talking about when you're generating a magnetic field, either permanent magnet or electromagnet, that energy's radiating out. I mean, the radio waves, you can detect all of this. You know, AM, FM, don't matter. All of it.
Shaziz, I've logged off of the page now because I cut it off when I called in. But I came across an article a while back about in Africa, they've got a natural nuclear reactor. And it's 2 billion years old.
And it's still producing.
Well, what they said is they found natural uranium ore with about one third of the level of radioactivity that was expected. And they kind of got a bit freaked out with it at first. And after years and years of arguing and studying and swapping pocket protectors and then putting post-it notes all around the monitor and generally looking grey and boring, they come up with the conclusion that the only way it can have one third less radioactivity is if it had been through a nuclear effect.
Yep.
So they found a set of conditions about 2 billion years ago that all came together in like a perfect storm to create a natural nuclear reactor.
Well, I want to point something out. You know, everybody knows about the Fukushima radioactive problem going on there. All right? Well, first off, underneath that land that's underneath the reactor, when that radioactive material got so hot that it literally melted through the floor, all right, everybody kept saying, well, it's going to continue to melt through, it's going to hit the Earth's core, it's going to do this, it's going to do that, and all this kind of stuff. But what they totally missed out on was their own laws of physics, which clearly states, you know, whenever something that hot, it melts through the floor, gets down in there. Well, guess what's underneath that ground is sand. You got right now a radioactive core that is completely encased in glass and can be removed easily. It's that easy. And if everybody's in panic mode over the Fukushima radiation leak, step back and look at the big picture going on here. The people are worried because of everything they've been told about radioactive material. And the governments don't seem to be that big of a concern. They're not rushing over there like it's doomsday scenario and trying to get this resolved. I mean, think about this. If the nations of the world were truly concerned about what's going on over there at Fukushima, then it would be a multinational effort for everybody to get over there, conceal this thing off, get it contained, and get everything situated so that the doomsday doesn't come around. But they're not. And you don't hear about it on mainstream news. You don't hear about it other than in alternative media. You don't hear about it other than people talking about it because of all these what the book says about radiation. Now, if you go out there and look at that video nuclear scare scam, and this guy was back there in the day, they were mixing this stuff by hand, and he's sitting there talking about eating it and drinking the water out of the cooling pools and everything like that, and he's still
swimming in it.
Yeah, swimming in it. So, now you step back, you use your critical thinking, and you ask yourself, wait a second. They said if an atomic bomb went on over there, that it'd be 100 years to 1,000, possibly 2,000 years or more before you could ever go back in there, or you'd die from radiation sickness. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, both. There are thousands of people to this very day living there. And I don't know if there's any physical survivors to this day, but whenever I was alive, when I was over in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
When I was alive?
Yeah. When I was over there, I knew that there were some physical survivors who weren't directly in the blast zone, who were far enough away that they didn't get severely burnt, but just right outside the blast zone, far enough away to where they didn't die. And they lived to be old folks, literally. And they should have been dead by all definitions of everything explained to you in school. All right, climb underneath your desk, put your hands over your head, and duck down. That's your best advice for a nuclear attack. Seriously?
Shaziz, I have a book. I have a book in my bookcase by a guy called Dr. Aidan McCarthy. He was in Nagasaki when they dropped the bomb. He was a doctor in the British military.
Yeah.
He joined the RAF. And he was in charge of a work crew in a factory on the day they dropped the bomb. And he lived into his late 70s.
He lived long enough to write a book, eh?
It was only kind of at the end of his life that people were asking him questions. Because he'd had I think it was a stroke or an aneurysm or something, and he was taken to hospital. And they were kind of doing a physical examination, and they said, "What the hell happened to you?" And it was really, he was tortured in prison or war camps. They just kept beating him around the head with sticks. And then he started telling his story about what had happened, and they said, "Oh my God, you've got to write this stuff down." And he was a commanding officer. But it's called A Doctor's War. In the Republic of Ireland, it was on the A-level syllabus for a very long period of time for English literature. But, I mean, he goes into kind of a lot about what happened during the war, but at the same point, he was there when they dropped the bomb, and he lived for at least another 30 or 40 years afterwards.
There's the key, man. If everything is so tragic, as they say, then why aren't the governments of the world over there on top of it? Because they know. They're not worried about it. They're not going to go and spend their money to clean up something that, you know, they feel that they can just do themselves. If it's not a doomsday scenario, right now, underneath that plant, down there in the sand, because there's a lot of sand underneath there. Underneath there in that sand is a big ball of glass with radioactive material inside of it. And so, well, it's that easy.
Do you remember what Congressman Bongwater said?
He said a lot of stuff.
Well, one of the things he said in particular was, "A redneck never makes a mess in his own garden. He takes it to China."
Yeah. So, you know, there you go. There's a lot of different things out there that we've been told, you know, and the laws of physics that they say are written in stone. And I'm defying them because I don't believe it. You know, I just flat out refuse to believe that the laws of physics are written in stone, because there's still things that we don't know about things. You know, even the electron, does it exist or does it not exist? Is the atom, is oxygen in the center of the atom or what? You know, who knows? Can't see that far. We ain't got nothing powerful enough to see down with clarity to literally see something that's supposedly spinning around the atom, so we don't know. You know, electron microscope, that's a misnomer. You know, you look at that, it calls it electron microscope. Well, electron microscope can see pretty far down to the surface and show you wonders that you would never have seen otherwise. But to this very day, nobody has a picture of an electron. Nobody. So what's really going on down there?
What, like Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah, nobody saw them.
Yeah, nobody's got a picture of them either.
Yeah.
They got some receipts from when they sold it to them, but they don't know where they are now.
Well, what do you say we take a quick coffee break and throw out a tune?
Oh, I just wanted to say, I've been kind of waiting for the break there. We were talking about lightning there, and talking about attracting it and bringing it down and all that stuff. I had a antenna farm pretty much on my property when I lived in Virginia. A bunch of bamboo with aluminum foil tape cut to length and made perfect one-to-one standing wave ratios and stuff for all the different bands on the ham band that I was using. And I cleaned out the shed, and I found a mirror and I propped it against a tree. I set it on, I kind of set the middle of the bottom of it on one of them roots that come up, that grow out the bottom of the tree, and then leaned it up against the tree, nice and straight up and down, and basically forgot about it. And I had an extension cord going out to a charger to my pickup truck to charge my battery. Well, I had, luckily I had unplugged that, and I also had it unplugged from the battery, and the terminals were on the ground. The extension cord was unplugged inside, but it was still connected to the battery charger. It did, lightning came down being attracted to the radio signal, and it went down the tree through the mirror. I'm sure some of it went through, you know, through the tree and through the, you know, through the bark down to the root and everything, but some of it went through that mirror. And it had burnt off a beautifully fine etched pattern, intricate pattern. All the everywhere the lightning had traveled on the mirror, it blew the mercury off, or the silvering, and it made a beautiful pattern. And you could see the intricate pattern of it, and the lengths of the frequency in it, and how it reverberated through the mirror. It was symmetrical up and down with a different pattern than it was left and right, because the mirror was different, was longer than it was as wide. That thing was beautiful. I didn't notice it till like a day or two afterward. I started calling the Wavy TV 10 to come take, oh, that's old news. So I called the newspaper and I called all this. I just thought people ought to see it, at least get a picture of it. And I never did get a picture of it. I called one of the universities, and they said, yeah, well, we'll have to come down and take a look at it. It'll be about a week. I left the property one day, came back, and that sucker was gone. Don't know if the university got it or whatever, or one of my friends got it, but I really wished I'd had a picture of it to show people. I could actually draw this pattern. It looked like the sun coming up over the horizon, and then reflecting on lake water that was smooth like glass. So it had round circles, but it had a dividing line dead center across the middle that looked like a landscape. And all the radiant lines that came out from the middle of it were, oh, probably about 4 to 4.5 inches. And then you'd see like another ring, and then other patterns. And as it got towards the corners, it did all sorts of squigglies that exactly matched on all four corners. It was awesome.
But one thing's for sure, you ain't control of nature, man. Nature is beautiful. I mean, the power. If you've ever looked at some of the biggest fulgurites found, and the way that that lightning comes down, it's just mind boggling. It's amazing.
And you look at those fulgurites; they have a definite internodial length between where they branch off and all. And so did this mirror, which told me that lightning has a definite resonant frequency.
Well,
it doesn't strike once. It strikes like 8 or 9 times before it stops.
We're literally sitting on a thermal electric generator of epic proportions. There is more powerful on this, more power on this planet than we could ever use in all of our lifetimes, and then some. You know, there's enough radioactive waste around there. That energy, as it's decaying, has potential energy in all frequencies. I don't care whether it be acoustic wave or static energy or whatever. It can all be stored energy, used energy. That's why I'm on this static motor right now, because if you can produce a high enough static charge to literally reproduce what nature's already doing, we already know the power of lightning. I mean, lightning can be really destructive. And it's going on 24/7.
We better get
this.
Yeah.
Do you know what the Italian mafia and Somalians have in common? They've both got an issue with the disposal of nuclear waste.
Well, there's a, yeah. You know, everybody's like, don't put it over here, don't put it over there, you know, because you know, the mainstream science guys all said, yo, you're going to die if it's in your neighborhood. But once again, I got to ask the question, if it's that dangerous, how come the governments of the world ain't on top of the Fukushima, you know, the Chernobyl? You can't go in there, but they let the guy go in there and go fishing, and he's still alive.
Shaziz, I used to fish outside the back of Dungeness B power station. It's a nuclear power station in Kent. We used to go night fishing to catch mackerel because they love the warm water.
Well,
and that was probably 28 years ago now.
Well, and the natural reactors that you're talking about and the uranium out there in the world, you know, I had a friend of mine talk about he lived next to a uranium mine, wanted to know if he should be concerned. I'm like, you know, about drinking the water and everything. I said, how long have you been there? You know, oh, 20 some odd years or something like that, you know. And I'm like, well, he seemed to be doing all right. What about the people that were there before you? You know, how'd they fare, you know? So,
not to bring it down, there's two things that we can be promised in life. Our first breath and our last breath.
Yep. All I'm saying,
you know, that's kind of it. What you do in between is either between yourself and your own conscience or yourself and your God.
There never has been an energy crisis on this planet. That's one thing we've never had, an energy crisis.
Yeah, no.
We've had a massive energy crisis, but it's the waste of energy, and that energy is human potential.
I think it's the waste that they stick down under the ground due to fracking that makes us have a clean water shortage.
Well, look, man, even in the internal combustion engine, they waste gas. They build motors that waste fuel. Literally, you wouldn't have to have a catalytic converter on your car if the doggone thing functioned efficiently. If you're sending it into a jet and the combustion is in the milliseconds, whenever that thing ignites the gas and pushes down the piston, it's obvious that the majority of that fuel is going to go out the exhaust. And instead of having stinky old fuel out the other side or running too lean, as they would say back in the day, you got to burn it. You got to reburn it. You got a catalytic converter with exotic materials in there that get heated and they stay hot for a long time. And as that exhaust is going down through there, it reignites that fuel, burns it before it gets back out the other end.
If you got energy lost due to the heat.
Yeah.
That never used. Only 5% of the combustion actually, power made from the combustion actually reaches the rear tires.
So if you took and sent that same amount of fuel, cut back on how much fuel you're putting in there, and you vaporize that fuel before it ever even gets in there, all you're sending in is literally a vapor. And that vapor is more powerful than all that gas. There's where you get your problem. It's not the liquid portion that you got to worry about. It's the vapor. And the vapor can be ignited with something as simple as a spark. So, you know, there's a lot of power potential in just a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of fuel. Just like we know there's a lot of power potential in just a tiny bit of water if you separate the hydrogen and oxygen. And they've known this forever and a day. I mean, Henry Ford had a carburetor to get over 100 miles to the gallon, and that was when the car was first coming out. If he could do 100 miles a gallon, you can imagine what modern-day technology could get if they, instead of sending the fuel through the injectors the way that they do, if they refined it down to a process to where all you're sending in there is vapors instead of, only about 20, 30 miles to the gallon, you're getting a couple hundred miles to just a little bit. You see the difference there?
Yeah. Charles Nelson Pogue, 1936, had a claim that he could get up to 200 miles a gallon out of a vaporizing carburetor.
Right.
Well, there's a reason why the alcohol-burning cars are more powerful than the gasoline cars. Because alcohol evaporates quickly. And it ignites quickly. And it has a lot of power potential. You can take a little alcohol, a 5-horse Briggs & Stratton, shift it over to burn on alcohol and have one on gasoline. I guarantee you that one with the alcohol is going to outrun that gasoline one every single time.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you one thing. Like I'm a zero turn if I got a problem and I'm not too sure if it's gas or what. Rather than taking the spark plug out and putting a little fuel in the cylinder or dumping it into the car, If you don't want it to just go vroom, and drop out, you can take that filter and through that hole on the bottom side, you just pour in a little gas and then tip it around all sides so all of that filter gets wet. Stick it back on. That thing will run almost a whole minute while you can sit there and rev it up and choke it to have the vacuum of that engine sit there and suck all the, put a nice vacuum and suck all the gasoline jets clean and clear the crap out of it. I've gotten so many things running that way. A new crap on the side of the road, someone said, it won't start, I can't get it to start. You get it like that, and sometimes you have to clean your carburetor, but sometimes you don't. But you'll at least know whether it's the carburetor or not, because sooner or later it'll die as the filter dries out. And it doesn't take much gas to run it a whole minute that way.
Well,
it's a lot less than what you'd use going through the jets and trying to make a somewhat fine vapor. Fumes are much, much finer.
Yeah, with all that said, we know this stuff. All right, and if modern day technology can't design something that can vaporize fuel and then send it into a combustion chamber, then it has to be intentional. If the average Joe's figured this out, the gas fumes are more dangerous than the actual gas itself.
Right.
Then it has to be intentional. And there's other guys out there that come out with carburetors that are really super fine, and suddenly, you know, they think they're going to make some money off of it. They try to get it into the market, and either they're bought off or, you know, the alternative, you know. and so it never makes it to market.
You know, like Stanley Myers.
Yeah. People want to sell their oil. And if you know that there's a better fuel out there, and you can prove it, then you got problems, because they got trillions of gallons worth of oil that they're trying to sell to you that you don't need. And my suggestion is,
industrial hemp,
if you can, yeah,
a good crop of industrial hemp that is grown for seed can produce 3,000 liters of oil.
Well,
the average family that drive 25 miles to work and back every day, 5 days a week, plus shopping at weekends and the odd holiday, would have the potential to be able to grow enough fuel for their vehicle if they worked out how to make biofuels to run their vehicle for a year and their home heating system off 4 acres of industrial hemp with 2 to 3 crops a year.
Well, you know what?
Yeah.
It's just crazy, because over there in Europe, there were guys taking plastic bottles and making petrol.
Yep.
All right. Well, we know this stuff in here, yet we are. And everybody, when people tell me that there's an energy crisis, I just, you know, I look at them cross-eyed. They're like, where's it at? Where's the energy crisis? The only energy crisis is the fact that people want to charge you for it. It's
free. Probably do it with kudzu on 1 acre.
Well, there's so many different... Anything's a fuel. Anything out there. I got a friend that goes around and all he does is get the doggone waste oil that people are so concerned about, because EPA tells them that they can't have it on their property and it costs them too much to get rid of it. And so he'll go over and he'll get 50-gallon barrels of it, and he's running old diesel engines off of it. And he ain't paying for fuel.
Who are the EPA?
Idiots, as far as I'm concerned. They said that CO2 is toxic.
But they call themselves the Environmental Protection Agency. Who are they protecting them from? And what?
Well, I think the EPA is basically there to protect the corporations. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. It has nothing to do with protecting the environment. You know, otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about this stuff. You know?
Mate, it's not for me to tell anybody to think anything.
In the old days, your grandma...
I would ask if they considered the question.
Your grandmother and grandfather didn't have to ask anybody if they could do anything. If they wanted to drive, they drove. If they needed to do... They didn't have any anybody above them telling them what they can and cannot do. They didn't have to buy a bunch of permits or licenses. Nowadays, if there's anything that you need and want to do, they want you to buy a license.
Do you know what the bootleggers used to do in order to get rid of the evidence?
Stick it in the tank.
Yeah, they had it in the. They had it. They were driving the car off of their alcohol, and if the cops got behind them, all they had to do is take them on a joyride until they ran out of gas. Now they get the fine for speeding or eluding or whatever, but there was no alcohol left to be charged with. So all they got to do is stay away from the guy long enough to run it out of gas. That was it.
Well, it was kind of, the engines at the time were capable of running on ethanol, and effectively what they were doing, they were driving around with a fuel tanker in the back of the truck.
Yeah.
In one in maybe 32-ounce bottles.
Anyway, let's take a quick music break, get some coffee, and come back and finish off the show. What do you say?
Sounds good.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody. Listen to Shaziz Mad Science and all the craziness therein. Peace and love.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission. To explore strange new worlds. To seek out new life and new civilizations. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to Shaziz Mad Science. Old Muddy's over there experiencing gas problems right now. Anyway, the Lord Kelvin generator, the Hoxby device, the Wimshurst, the Van de Graaff, all those are devices to look into as far as static energy, the atmosphere motor, and static generators, and so on and so forth. Those are all good devices to look into. Nature has provided all the energy we could ever use in our entire lifetime and our children's, 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 children's into infinity and beyond. And as if you want to try to look into trying to figure out a way to run your car for less fuel, then pay some attention to how hydrogen cells and the flashback arresters work. You know, hydrogen, when it builds up the pressure inside there, forces the hydrogen, because it's hydrogen is a small molecule, forces it through the wire mesh that they put down for the flashback arrester. The only purpose for the flashback arrester is to not ignite that hydrogen vapor and all the way back down the hose. If you go back and look at some of my videos called Hydrogen Danger, you'll see you can literally watch that hose light up as it goes and makes its way back down to the rest of that hydrogen. So if you can pressurize that fuel into a vapor, force it through a flashback arrester, and then put it into your combustion chamber, you can run that vehicle on a whole lot less fuel than it normally takes on a standard model. And so, you know, with that said, we don't have no energy crisis. We never did have an energy crisis, and it drives me insane. That's why I call it mad science, because the basics of it all, you know, it just, I won't follow the standard model. Does it?
Two-thirds of the Earth is covered with an energy that's untapped.
Oh, yeah. The Navy just came out and said that by the 2016 they were going to be running their ships on hydrogen. Now, wouldn't that be nice to not have to have thousands of gallons worth of fuel inside your ship, or you could just pick your fuel up as you go?
Yeah, be awesome. You got wind, you got the sun to sit there and basically make enough energy to separate it and use it in its best form.
Yeah, I got a train going by, and I got rain and thunder and lightning outside. We're talking about lightning. Power, man.
Yeah, you got a train going by, you better look out and make sure it's not a tornado. Last time I heard a train where it shouldn't have been, that's what was going on, and I dismissed it as a train.
Well, I live about a quarter mile away from a train track, so I get to hear the train all the time. Sometimes it's soothing and sometimes it's annoying, like if I'm trying to do a live radio broadcast and I got the window open and to get fresh air, then I get to hear the train, the toot-toot of the horn, right there live.
Guys, I'll trump you on that. I get Mirage jets flying less than 1,000 feet above the top of my apartment.
Cool.
Not when you start fiddling with orgone devices, because they will not be happy with that. Well, if the Mirage jets aren't bad enough, we get the C-10 transporters as well.
Yeah.
They're four pops, and they are seriously noisy. They make the windows rattle.
Well, they got them Chinook helicopters that like to fly low over my house every once in a while, and every once in a while you get like a Black Hawk or something like that flies over, and it'll rumble the whole house.
But there's nothing worse than somebody else that wants to steal someone's idea, is there?
Yeah. Yeah, I get a lot of interesting traffic above my house during certain experiments, so, you know.
What was the dimensions of your motor again?
My static motor?
Yeah.
Well, according
exactly.
to According to Steve's deal, it's the size of a grapefruit is how big the rotor is. It's either a grapefruit, a croquet ball, or a softball. And as far as measurement-wise, wasn't no measurement. It was eyeball, you know. I just eyeballed it in. That's why it's not perfectly straight and it wobbles. But, like, by all standards of functionality and the laws of physics, this thing should not turn, period. It should not work. But it did. And this is the reason why I do the things the way that I do them. When I did the pop-pop boat deal, which I was surprised, we didn't get no entries into that thing. But, you know, that, we had to probably just run it again. But
I'll give you a video of mine.
They
Will you allow me a slight offensive euphemism?
Go for it.
They're about the size of the pair that Hillary Clinton's got. If she thinks she's going to run for president with her record.
Hey, if she gets elected, we already know that the system's corrupt.
That's true.
But if she gets elected, then that's just more confirmation on top of confirmation.
But
either way, back to
they're half the size of the ones Maggie Thatcher had.
The pop-pop boat, I didn't put one piece of measurement in that entire deal. I don't know if you guys remember the show we did, and we were talking about mathematics and how it wouldn't work out because you couldn't scale it up because the math wasn't there or whatever. And then when I got in this dispute with the mathematician guy, and I said, look, I won't even measure it. If I do any measurement, I'll use a piece of string, you know. And I did. I didn't measure it. And if you look at the boat, the big version of it, you can obviously see I took absolutely no pride in its work. And I literally set fire to it the first time around. And so when I put it back together and slathered on the Bondo and sealed the thing up, the thing was too heavy. And it only had two turns of a coil in there.
That thing was beautiful before you decided to run it.
Yeah.
You didn't get it on camera.
Well, I wish I would have, because Beverly was doing a radio show at the time whenever I set fire to it in the background. Anyway, you can see in there it's not moving fast, and if it had a bigger pull, it could have built up some speed, but either way, it did move. It moved under its own power, and that was the key. And so refined, you could literally build a full-size version of that pop-pop boat. Some people call them putt-putt boats. I don't care what you call it. Either way, it's a solid-state boat motor that all you do is heat up the tubing, and it causes pressure out the other end that makes the boat go forward. It's so simple. And so you could build a full-size version that you could burn charcoal or logs or use induction heating or however you want to do it. It doesn't matter. And we're not creating anything. We're not even defining our laws of physics. All we're doing is moving energy from point A to point B and getting work done. That's it. Copper wire is nothing more than the railroad track for the train, you know? That's it. We're just guiding the energy.
I made mine by taking a regular soda can, and I took the biggest section I could there and felled it after cutting it out of the can. And I kind of whittled it down just a little bit of fold and a little bit of epoxy. And I even made the tubes out of the can by rolling them up kind of tight. And two Venom bottles, those aluminum bottles, you know. I put them in, did everything with that as well. And so it was a little bit longer than the normal boat, but it was small and it was light. And the thing never did run the same way twice, but man, I mean, it moved along pretty quick. My prop was the front end of my boat was a little heavy.
Put a video out, because I'd love to see it, man.
Yeah, I put it in the pool, and I ran it in the tub like four or five times. I always giggle when it goes off. It's pretty funny. It wasn't your standard pop-pop boat, but very enjoyable. And I even took, you know, where it's got that big smile of fangs and stuff on the front of it. I even sat there and used some of the contour just to make it, you know, just to make it cosmetically cool. I will definitely make a video and throw it up.
Stephen Gibbons put in a comment in the chat room over at ShazizRadio.com in the super chat there. He said, there's enough alcohol in 1 year's yield of an acre of potatoes to drive the machinery necessary to cultivate the fields for 100 years. Henry Ford. See that? You can make alcohol out of potatoes. You can make alcohol out of corn, fruits. Instead of throwing your fruits in the dump because they're rotted, use that rotted deal to ferment it into alcohol and then burn it in your car, man.
Right. So, you know, the calories that is needed to push a regular Humvee or SUV for 1 mile is 53 donuts.
Well,
Boomer used to go around all the donut shops and still does. He gets all the used, all the old, not used, but the old donuts, the day olds and stuff that they're ready to throw out. He takes them, put them in a 55-gallon drum, fills it up to about a little over a quarter, and then just fills it up with water. The grease,
so he's making donut wine.
Oh, no, he's making fuel.
Oh, donut fuel.
It's free donuts and 55-gallon drums. It's got the sugar. It's got the yeast. It's got everything in, including a grease layer to keep the oxygen out of the water.
Yeah, there's stories about the folks up in the jailhouse taking bread and making liquor, man. You know?
Yep.
I mean, come on, folks. You know, as long as you want to pay the electric company, then go ahead, be my guest, and who am I to tell you what to do? If you want to pay the electric company, go ahead. But I set out to prove energy's free, and I think I've more than proven energy's free. It's just a matter about, you know, what kind of device you want to use to tap into it. It's that simple. There's exotic materials out there, one of which is that diode that I put that video in here about that Ryan showed. There's energy potential there, tapping into other energy. You know, every time somebody keys up on the radio, you can grab that energy out of the air. Tesla's radiant energy patent, wireless energy, all of it we know is possible. Hydrogen, you know, there's electric that you can pick up off of hydrogen production. There's so many different ways in order to tap into the energy, and right now we do it with the worst possible manner. We use a brute force magnetic field to literally shake loose the electrons to get the electron flow in the deal. And I've been saying all along that you don't have to go through all that effort in order to tap into that energy, and static energy is going to be the easiest, cheapest way to prove once and for all, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that energy is free. Now, you got a crappy toaster and a crappy refrigerator and a crappy heating system in your house. They're all energy inefficient from start to finish. And if you come out with a better one, I say don't tell anybody about it. Just enjoy the use of it, because the moment you tell somebody about it, they see that you're heading for their wallet. That's when you get the Stan Myers effect, or the Tesla effect, or how many others can you name, buddy?
I don't know, Shaziz, but would you be offended if I declined your VIP invitation to your water-based version of the Putt-Putt Hindenburg?
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't get on the Hindenburg, that's for sure. But, you know, that's why they started using helium. Okay, so, you know, there's two different ways. You could use a non-explosive gas, or you could use an explosive gas to float in the air. Your choice.
Well, I'll tell you what. Instead of using a helium balloon to get that wire up in the air, why don't you use a hydrogen balloon, and then you can see exactly how much energy is going through it.
Yeah. Get up there to the top.
You don't need to pay for either.
Once you get a couple thousand feet in the air, tell them the smoking lamp is lit. Smoke them if you got them.
Yeah, they get up there just so far, and then doggone any static will sit there and light the sucker off. That ought to be fun.
Yeah, what if they got hit by a bolt of lightning?
I'm sorry, yeah. It's probably safe until it leaks.
Well, what if the Hindenburg boat got hit by a bolt of lightning in the air?
Mm.
Yeah. That's lightning now.
It won't strike twice when that wire falls.
The point I'm saying is, look, there's a lot of different technologies and different methods and ways to put things together, guys, but you got to think safety as well.
Yeah, always practice Don't learn electrical safety by accident.
Unless you fancy hair by Shaziz.
Yeah. And you got to have the mad science hair. You ain't a mad scientist. That's all there is to it. You could be a good scientist with nice combed hair, but if you ain't got the wild hair, then you're not a mad scientist. That's how it works. That's the law of the West.
When I come up there, I'm visiting your barber. I want my hair just like yours.
Oh, that's easy, man. We'll hook you to the Van de Graaff generator, and while it's standing up, hit it with a bit of Beverly's hairspray, and yeah, you got it, man.
Do you remember those domes they used to put over women's heads to dry their beehives? Do you think you could fit a Van de Graaff generator into one of them?
Hey, that'd be cool if you could. Run around zapping everybody. Anyway, we're down to the last 2 minutes of the show. If anybody got anything really quick they want to say, I mean like really quick, don't be like 10 miles an hour long-winded.
Woodchuck as much wood as a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Yeah, and there's a lot of potential energy in that. Woodchuck ate some donuts and he got all that woodchucked. Alright guys, you've been listening to Mad Science. Stay tuned for the Hope Show, and hopefully everybody will join me on the Knights of the Round Table tomorrow, 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central Time. If you got pertinent ideas and information out there, just come on there and join in. That's what it's all about. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough, and that comes from Shaziz, the Mad Science Guy. And my buddies over here, Muddy and Steve there, and wherever Justin went. Thanks, guys. Peace and love to everybody. Take care.
Can you hear me? Give my creation fly!
21 gigawatts!
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.